amplifying diverse voices in the energy revolution. Here's your host, Amy Simpkins.
Welcome back to the Power Flow Podcast, your first Power Flow episode of 2024. Can you believe it? And we're here today with my guest, Sierra Fan, to kick us off in style in the new year. Sierra Fan is the co-founder and COO of Elu, providing software solutions for solar, storage, and EV charging companies to more easily onboard and manage their installers and technicians. She also founded Mi Panyar, a developer of solar and storage microgrids in Myanmar. Previously, she financed more than $10 billion in energy and infrastructure products while at Morgan Stanley, including 1.7 gigawatts of utility-scale renewable energy in the United States. Sierra Fan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you have quite a portfolio there, and I really want to hear about Myanmar. But first, before we go there, let's talk about what you're doing right now. Let's talk about Elu. Tell me what you're most excited about and how the platform helps the clean energy transition.
Yeah, sure. I think we're at a really exciting state of the clean energy industry and also our efforts to combat climate change, where, you know, the mantra is just deploy, deploy, deploy. And there's so much cool technology out there to help achieve this. I think, you know, one of the most difficult things now is there's all these cool kind of hardware technologies, whether that's solar, whether that's more advanced control of that kind of solar energy, whether that's energy storage, whether that's EV charging, you know, IoT gateways. But there's always that challenge of actually getting these things on the ground. And I know on this podcast and also generally, people have talked about kind of the workforce issue and the workforce challenge. But from, you know, from our perspective, we've experienced this on the ground working on projects and being a developer of microgrid projects, but we just need to make it easier and provide a platform and a tool that helps these hardware companies more easily tell their technicians and guide their technicians through all the things that they need to be doing on the ground and support them and actually have accountability from the technicians, you know, that documentation of what actually happened on the ground on this project and how do you have that track record so if something goes wrong you can go back and, you know, do the right things to either fix it or, I think that's right now the challenge that hasn't really been figured out. And as we're expanding, that will just become more severe, and we're excited to be building something that turns, you know, currently these instructions and accountability and things from being in kind of PDFs and things are hard to read and hard to access when you're on the ground into something that's mobile focused, super easy to share and easy to use and pleasant to use on the ground, that very clearly step by step walks technicians through what they need to do.
Anyways. A tool that is pleasant to use. I feel like that could be like a tagline just right there. Like, who would have thought a tool that could be pleasant?
That was such an insight where a lot of these things, you know, on the ground, you right now, most people have smartphones with them when they're kind of out there installing things. PDFs are the worst things to use on your smartphone. If you're scrolling through kind of a large kind of user manual and you're trying to get to like page 30 and zoom in and figure all that out, that's just not the right format for things. And a lot of it is how do you make this information, which exists, more accessible and link it up to the people who actually need it.
So I heard you say earlier, you know, the mantra of deploy, deploy, deploy. And I have noticed the same. And so it's funny because we have a lot of there's a lot of technologists that are saying, wait, before you just assume we're ready to deploy, there's other technologies we want to be thinking about. And you're sort of thinking about the back half of the deployment, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so providing that documentation, I mean, what we find is that so many systems go in and like no one ever goes back to check like how it's doing. Is that part of the problem you're solving?
Yeah, it's both. And I think they're very closely related. So if you look at what a kind of pre-commissioning check or a commissioning check process is, that's very similar to the kind of process that should be followed if for someone to go in and inspect the project at a later stage or to recommission a project at a later stage. A lot of those things are shared. And right now, I think there's challenges on both sides of that, on the initial install. So you want to make sure the initial install is going in correctly. And right now that is still a challenge. There's, we get different estimates from the hardware companies that we're talking to, but they're anywhere from say like 10 to 20% of these initial installs, aren't done correctly for some equipment and needs to go have people go back in and try to figure out kind of what went wrong. Why is it not showing any connection? Why are the parameters not set correctly? And that's a huge loss of efficiency and how quickly we're getting these kind of equipment working on the ground. But ongoing O&M is a complete issue as well, where there's, a lot of times it's an incentive problem where these projects aren't structured to incentivize people to kind of go back in and make sure they're working. Sometimes it's, a lack of capacity and local capacity. And we're definitely kind of tackling both of those. One of the things I'm really excited on the O&M side is, and that's part of, how we got started in Myanmar with ELU as an internal tool as well, is if you provide a clear workflow, so this is mobile focused, step-by-step, something that someone can go out there and swipe through and take photos on the step or record a reading or record a serial number in each step, you can actually take someone who's a facility manager, right? Someone who's not even an electrician, and get all the facility managers, for example, for this kind of, a number of sites, right? Whether that's for national parks, whether that's for the Coast Guard or, number of facilities, and you get a initial report and inspections that the facility manager can just do to get an idea of, what is the state of the systems that then you can prioritize and figure out which ones it makes sense to send people out to. We see so many instances and we, work closely with NREL, the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, where you actually have NREL experts who are going out to the field to inspect the system. But the result is they go in and they say there's three inverters, two of them aren't even online or aren't even connected, and one of them is not generating any output. You could have done that much more efficiently. The facility manager, if they knew what to look for, if they're guided through the process of this is what you need to look for, this is what you need to record, they can just do that. And then you don't need a renewable energy expert to go out and collect that basic level of information. And I think that helps these O&M activities become more economical, more affordable. They're kind of two sides of the same coin. People are like, oh, O&M is so expensive. Then if you buy out, it's so expensive. But if we can leverage kind of facility managers to do that, or local electricians to do that, or kind of local technicians to do that, you can actually do that much more economically and then enable more O&M to be done.
I love that it's like, I mean, most of the facility managers that I know want to be involved in the system. They want to know what they're looking at, even if they're, non-technical or at least non-electrical technical. And empowering them to be part of the process, I would think also gives a lot of buy-in to doing projects.
That's right. Yeah. And I think, now we're moving into a world where these projects are much more, say, containerized or modularized. They are a set of a couple of different equipment that is connected versus built from scratch and kind of designed and pieced together. And so the kind of work that needs to be done on the ground is much more like, you know, here, this is a X brand inverter. This is the model. And this is the process or the procedure to follow when you're working with this particular model. There's the things that you need to look for. You know, here's, you know, where you need to look. Here's the terminals for it. You know, here's the pictures that you need to take. It becomes much more specific to the particular equipment. So I think working with the hardware providers, the manufacturers, that is the gap that needs to be linked, right? The procedures are very much specific to equipment and modularized versus starting from first principles, kind of electrician kind of, you know, skills. And so we're trying to bridge that gap also from the hardware provider, you know, give the hardware providers and the hardware kind of manufacturers the tool to digitize those processes in the easy to access way so they can be shared to, you know, whether that's the technician, whether that's the electrician, whether actually going in and energizing this, installing this, or the facility manager who's going in and doing kind of a first level inspection of this, this particular inverter or this particular battery. So
you have, ILU has, you know, end users that could be facility managers, could be installers, and then obviously the hardware manufacturers are part of the ecosystem. Who's the target market for?
The target market is the hardware manufacturers and the OEMs. So we basically provide, instead of having to build a installer app from scratch, which we know people have been doing, and that's very expensive and takes a lot of time, you can fully use the ILU platform to track, you know, who are your network of installers and also kind of people who are doing work to install or service your products, and provide them kind of the step-by-step instructions, which you can build on our platform, or we can also provide services to help you build and help you digitize from your existing manuals. And they also see the data that's being collected as the people on the ground are following through these workflows and these instructions. For example, the photos are being taken and things like that. So they're able to pull the data and get that accountability where they say on this site, you know, here was a workflow that was followed, here was the data that was collected from it.
Fantastic. So I'm really curious, you're a co-founder of the company. Yes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And tell me about the genesis of the idea, because this is, first of all, really brilliant and I think very, very needed, because installations for distributed energy projects is like the wild, wild west. And so providing accountability and documentation to that process is just so needed. But it's also kind of a little bit esoteric, I think, when you first think about, you know, doing a distributed energy project, it's probably not the first thing you think about. So tell me about the genesis of the idea for ILU.
Yeah, this really kind of brings us back to Myanmar and even before that. So I'm co-founder of ILU. My other co-founder is Natasha Allen. We've been friends since high school. So we both discovered the world of solar and distributed energy together at the start of high school, you know, more than a decade ago. And we both just fell in love with it. And previous to ILU, we founded a solar microgrid developer in Myanmar called Mifanya together. And that really, you know, was the genesis of ILU in a way that it illuminated the challenges of actually getting these systems on the ground in a way that, you know, if you're not there doing it and helping support an install and helping support a troubleshooting, you don't understand how difficult it is and how much time and effort it takes out of the teams to be able to manage that. I think this is particularly difficult in a place like Myanmar. So the type of projects we were doing there were, solar and battery hybrid systems, microgrids around, you know, 100, 200 kilowatt peak that powered a community of, say, you know, 1,000 or a couple thousand people. These were energy access projects. So we were bringing in first-time 24/7 electricity, usually offsetting diesel generators that people are using and bringing in kind of renewable energy for a whole community instead of lots of individual diesel generators. And working in a place like Myanmar, you're not going to be able to find a solar technician off the street because they're not there. And so, you know, but there are electricians, you know, there's lots of diesel generators, half the country is powered by them. I think the number is something crazy, like 13,000, you know, diesel generator run small grids that are powering, you know, a lot of the country. So there are electricians out there and they have, you know, general knowledge of how to work with similar systems. They just don't know how to install a solar inverter or a controller or a battery. So we really got the idea of, you know, some of you have smartphones even in Myanmar, and, you know, these are electricians with some basic skill. We put together some training programs, kind of intervention at first, where, you know, they come in and they learned, and we actually thought, you know, a training intervention in person isn't the best way of doing it. If they just have these instructions in a super legible, accessible way as they were doing this, they can just do this from their instructions. We don't need to fly everyone in and do a 2-week training because these people already had some basic kind of, you know, electrical skills and kind of some knowledge. So that was what got us thinking about, you know, ELU. And then also the genesis was really, it was such a headache. I think dealing with issues with installs and troubleshooting. I'm sure, you know, you've been on those kind of customer support type calls or technical support calls, and you're just going back and forth on WhatsApp, sending photos. You're like, can you take a photo of this? What about a photo of this? Can you send me this? Where that becomes repetitive because you're working with similar systems. And we were thinking, if we can just put that together, they can just go and take all the required photos and all the required, you know, steps, and we don't have to walk people through this every time. So that was another part of how we were thinking about this. And it really came from personal experience of, like, this is so painful. We try to look for software. We're like, someone must have built something that makes this a little bit easier. We tried looking for it. We couldn't find it. And, you know, both of us grew up in Palo Alto, Silicon Valley. We're like, we know how to code an app. And that's how we got started with this.
That's awesome. Did you spend a lot of time in Myanmar?
So Natasha was there longer than I was. She was doing kind of a Watson fellowship there and had done a master's program where, you know, this was her master's thesis, was looking at grassroots electrification efforts in Myanmar. I was there for a little bit less than a year. So less time kind of living in Yangon, but I absolutely love Myanmar. I love the country. It's such a sad story now, kind of what the country is going through and the reason we had to leave, with the political instability there. But I really hope, you know, they come back and things stabilize over there.
Yeah, definitely. I was in Myanmar on a tourism in 2014, which, you know, feels like it was yesterday, but actually is almost 10 years ago now. In 2014, I was there and I had actually, we were supposed to go up to Bagan and like see all the things you're supposed to see. Mm-hmm. And I had actually broken my ankle like a month prior, or no, that actually, was it 2014? It might have been 2013, actually. So fully 10 years ago, I had broken my ankle and we could stay in the city. So I stayed in Yangon and just explored around there. But also, like, I think this is super exciting to see that. I agree. They've been through so much as a people, as a country, just not even the recent stories, but, you know, for years and years. And so you can see how much fight they have to make things right and make things stable. So yeah, I agree with you. Sending out all the positive thoughts to them to work through this.
Yeah. Yeah, so, definitely. Yeah.
Well, go ahead if you had something else there.
I think there is, you know, one of the things I was thinking that I really loved about Myanmar and working with people there is there's such an entrepreneurial spirit. And I think it's actually really cool coming back to the U.S. and kind of comparing to our experience in Myanmar, where people think of these as completely different environments and completely different, you know, places and experiences. But in reality, what we were doing there and the kind of equipment, the kind of systems, the kind of work is identical to a lot of the microgrids, the smaller microgrids that are now being built in the U.S. and kind of residential solar and storage systems. You are getting them from the same manufacturers. They're the same equipment to what's going on, what's being built in a village in Myanmar. And I thought that's something that was really surprising to me thinking about it. And it says something around kind of the global nature of, you know, the energy transition and the kind of infrastructure we're moving towards. The entrepreneurial spirit, I think there's a lot of parallels there between Myanmar and the kind of electricians and technicians we're working with. They're called Misaya, or kind of fire teacher in Burmese, which I really love that term. And the contractors, installers, and kind of, you know, the big and small, a lot of kind of mom and pop companies, installers, contractors here who really want to learn and get into installing these new hardware and new products in the U.S. And I think so much about what we want to do, like these are such cool, you know, motivated entrepreneurial people that are doing this work. How do we make it easier for them to get the information they need and figure out how to, you know, they might be an electrical contractor who's moving into solar. They might be an electrical contractor who's moving into EV charging stations. How do we make that easier, right? Because the equipment needs to go in, and we have this pool of people who are motivated to kind of pick that up. You know, let's plug that gap.
I love that. I love that flow of conversation. I can really see how it affected your kind of development of ILU, and then also just that spirit of innovation in general. So kind of pivoting to talk about innovation, you know, what do you think, for kind of from your chair, I love to ask this to kind of all my guests. What do you see as the next step sort of as an industry for us to move innovation forward? And maybe what lessons can we learn from your projects in Myanmar, from this entrepreneurial spirit you saw there? How does that apply, you know, I'd say back to us in the U.S., but as you pointed out, in a globalized industry?
Yeah, I think I'm really excited about innovations that have their roots internationally, that are being brought back into, you know, the quote unquote developed world, whether that's U.S. or Europe. I think there's a lot of cool efforts happening overseas in emerging markets, because they're leapfrogging, you know, into a renewable kind of distributed smart type of energy and communication, you know, this type of infrastructure in a way that, you know, sometimes is more advanced than even the U.S. because they didn't have to go through the kind of traditional centralized kind of electrical infrastructure in the first place. They kind of leap to this new world. And we see ourselves, you know, so much of what we're building in ILU, we started building this for our internal Myanmar field team and subcontractor. We weren't thinking about this initially for the U.S. market. And the kind of interest that we've gotten in the U.S. And the kind of validation that we've gotten through, you know, the Department of Energy and the American Made Solar Prize and kind of all of those programs shows that the kind of thinking that, you know, maybe was spurred because of the context that we were in Myanmar, it, you know, will be really helpful to, you know, the energy transition in the United States and in other developed markets. And I think we're definitely not the only ones. It was pretty cool at RU Plus. I met some kind of other founders of, you know, U.S.-centric startups, and a lot of them have had experience working on energy access overseas, and a lot of them, you know, have either spent some time in sub-Saharan markets or Latin American markets, doing the kind of energy access related projects similar to what Natasha and I were doing in Myanmar. And I think there's a lot of kind of innovation or a different way of thinking that that opens up when you've worked in places that is going through this kind of leapfrogging versus being so immersed in kind of the way that the U.S. has done things in decades that maybe blocks potential ideas, right, and innovation. So I think that's a really cool opportunity. And that's, I think, something quite unique to the current day and age. I hope that will kind of open doors to new ideas and kind of move everyone forward.
Yeah, it feels like you can step away from our tendency to assume incremental innovation, and that taking those leaps can introduce more disruptive innovation because you have the possibility, the field of possibility is open to disruption. There's not so much to increment. And I totally agree with you that here in, you know, the Western world, the developed world, we tend to say, but we have this thing already. And so shouldn't we work within these constraints, even if the constraints are dumb? And so I love that perspective of saying, you know, it really does foster a lot of innovation, especially the disruptive kind.
Yeah. I know. I really think about kind of what we're doing at ELU a little bit like that, kind of disrupting both kind of manuals, I guess, and also training and just the concept of workforce development. I think, you know, workforce development is so important, but I think when people think workforce development, you think kind of traditional kind of training interventions or apprenticeships, where we're trying to fight against that narrow interpretation of what workforce development is. Why can't workforce development be guidance on the job and upskilling on the job? Because now we have a better kind of modularized equipment and also better software and smartphones to be able to do that on site, right? Why can't that be an expanded definition of workforce development that can be just as impactful as, you know, expanding kind of apprenticeship programs and things like that, which are also, you know, very important and very necessary, but just thinking bigger. Yeah.
Well, that's huge, especially right now as the Department of Energy has this influx of funding from the bipartisan infrastructure law that it all has community benefits requirements and specifically workforce development requirements. And so really good timing to shift people's thinking, because from what I've seen in companies that are applying for grant funding, because we've been on a handful of them over here, that it's hard for companies to think about, like, you know, what does this mean? What does workforce development mean and job quality? And, you know, how does this relate to what I'm doing, you know, by putting this project in the ground? It's caused, I think, a lot of us to think differently. And so this is yet another perspective. So I appreciate you bringing it.
Yeah.
So talk to me just for a minute about then the contrast, because, you know, working at the edge where you're bringing first energy access to a community, tell me how that differs, how that represented a shift for you compared to your work at Morgan Stanley.
Oh yeah, completely different. I think, you know, also for context, I've been interested in energy access and, you know, working in Southeast Asia in related projects for a long time. Actually, you know, with Natasha since high school, we were first working in solar home systems and kind of small scale solar lights back when that was kind of the cutting edge of kind of technology there. And then as microgrids got built up, we kept kind of tracking this new technology of, you know, this is something that could be even more impactful than kind of the smaller types of systems. So if anything, I was originally interested in, you know, energy access and then joined Morgan Stanley and did energy infrastructure banking to try to understand structurally how these types of projects are evaluated from a risk basis, you know, how they really come together when you bring this up to the largest projects that is being built in the world and, you know, in renewable energy, but also in traditional energy infrastructure industries, right? How are ports built? How are metro lines built? How are kind of gas generation plants built? And so I think, you know, what I found really helpful in my years at Morgan Stanley is how do you think about the different factors and the different elements that need to come together and the different potential risks, right? Whether that's financing risk, whether that's market risk, whether that's execution risk. And I think the same model of evaluating a project and trying to figure out whether it made sense actually was really helpful as we were bringing this to Myanmar and thinking about our projects there, even though that is a different scale and a different context. So I think there's a lot of kind of parallels there, but I think the biggest change in thinking and the biggest shock to me was really going back to the little things that need to happen on the ground that are difficult and aren't really talked about when you're at Morgan Stanley doing a large project. You just assume, you know, you don't assume things get done. You mitigate the risk that things don't get done from a contractual perspective or from an insurance perspective, but you're not really thinking at the level of, you know, how do you coordinate a team on the ground and how do you, you know, communicate and pass on information between people, which are really the little things that become tough and painful. So, you know, I went into Myanmar and building this thinking that the biggest challenge and the biggest hurdle to deploying distributed energy resources and this new this technology was financial. The thesis in my head was if only we had enough investment to bring this up, they would, you know, come online and that would happen. And I think it was a big kind of learning moment for me because in Myanmar, we weren't blocked for financial reasons. We were able to get funding. There was a great kind of World Bank supported program with the Myanmar government that provided, you know, subsidies to kind of private companies that were building this type of infrastructure. There were, you know, other large companies there, international companies with balance sheet that they wanted to invest in these projects. The difficult thing was really, you know, how do you find people who can install these things without screwing it up, like with enough, you know, with enough confidence that they can execute, and how do you build up the process to be able to do that? So that was not my way of thinking at all going into that. And that was, you know, very surprising to me and really drove, you know, both kind of Natasha's and my realization that this is a big hurdle and we want to work on tackling this. And we think this will make, you know, a large difference in our speed of decarbonization, the speed of deployment for these technologies.
Oh, that was such a rich reply. And you're blowing my mind because you're giving me a whole different perspective on things. So I appreciate that very much. And I'm going to have to go listen to that again to get all of the nuggets out of there. So we're kind of coming down here to the end of time. And so I just wanted to give you the opportunity, you know, what haven't we talked about that's important to you?
So one thing that we haven't really covered, and it's something that I'm pretty excited about, is kind of the intersection between these different types of equipment all in the energy transition. So we've talked quite a bit around kind of solar and batteries, which is specifically my background in Myanmar and kind of even before that in Morgan Stanley. But I think I'm also really excited about other types of infrastructure that needs to be deployed, like EV charging. And that is kind of a new industry to me. And I know you've talked to kind of other people in specifically EV charging on the podcast before. And I think it's an exciting opportunity to me to learn more about kind of this slightly different industry, well, very much interconnected industry, and think about, you know, are there ways, and I think, you know, with distributed energy there, there's a lot of overlap. What can we do that solves bottlenecks towards, you know, different types of assets at once. And I think there's cool innovations coming out in the finance side of things, in the control side of things, in the aggregation side of things, that help with that. But yeah, that's one other thing that I'm just excited for and is top of mind.
Yeah, I agree with you. And it's my experience as well. I would say that my company, MuGrid Analytics, is on the control side, like what you just said. And I think we see the same. Like when you have distributed energy, it's no longer out of sight, out of mind, but you see all these stovepipes start to come down, that energy really does touch everything. And so when you start to think about energy, okay, you start with generation. So you need some solar or you need some wind. And then, oh, well, you can't control solar and wind. So you need a battery because you need to have some controls, or you need some sort of storage, whether that's battery or something else. But there's all these other places where we consume energy that are part of the ecosystem. And, you know, how can we be smarter about all of those things too? So I love that from the controls problem, but it is really, I think, at the high level, the breaking down of those stovepipes that have been in place for years, because no one ever really thought about how electricity was related to vehicles, because vehicles weren't electric. So why would you think there was a connection there? I love to see that too. And to me, where there's, I always quote Guy Kawasaki, who was formerly at Apple. I think he's at Canva now. Anyway, his quote is, everything interesting happens at the edges. And so we start to see these edges of transportation and energy and food and climate. And when I mean climate, obviously there's global climate, but also like keeping people comfortable and HVAC and, you know, all of these things. And there's some really cool, I think, solutions to come at those edges.
Yeah, for sure. And it's just, you know, I think there's COP28 happening right now. So this is all very kind of top of mind in terms of, you bring up kind of global climate. And there is definitely an urgency towards all of this deployment, and kind of bringing this way back to the very beginning where you talked about, you know, deploy, deploy, deploy. There's, you know, a new report that has come out around just how we're coming close to various tipping points in terms of global climate. I think it was, you know, 3 out of 5 major tipping points, which is like thawing of the permafrost and the Greenland ice sheet melting, that are really inflection points and kind of almost points of no return, where we just end up in a much worse climate outcome. And so I think there's very much this urgency that we need all of these solutions to get on the ground, and we need people to work together and find, you know, almost system changes. What are tools that everyone can use to speed up the implementation and the deployment of all of these things, where the technology is already there? They just need to get on the ground, and we need to be faster about it. And so that definitely kind of motivates me and the team to be, you know, this needs to happen now. How do we break down these little kind of bottlenecks to things? But once again, it's, you know, all these different interrelated technologies. You mentioned HVAC, that's a big part of it too. How do we move faster to solve this kind of global issue?
I could seriously talk to you for another hour, but I won't. But this was super fun. Sierra Fan, thank you so much for coming on the show. If our listeners need to get in touch with you or with Elu, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah, so our website is www.elu.works. You can find a way to contact us on there, either with our hotline or with our email. And please reach out to me on LinkedIn also, just Sierra Fan at Elu there. I look forward to hearing from you.
Amazing. And thank you, listeners, again for giving us your time today to learn about an incredibly interesting facet of renewable energy and renewable energy deployment, not only here in the Western Hemisphere, but around the world. And we'll see you guys next time here at the whiteboard.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of the Power Flow Podcast. If you enjoyed the conversation, please share the episode with other innovators, leave us a positive review, and subscribe to Power Flow on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find show notes for this episode More great conversations, PowerFlow merchandise, and more at PowerFlowPodcast.com. PowerFlow is hosted by Amy Simpkins, produced by Devin Shanchuk, and managed by Laura Novak. See you next time here at the whiteboard.